Well, hello and welcome to another episode of the Capitol Record. I am this week out at the Acton Institute in Grand Rapids, Michigan. I cannot tell you how many great speakers, thinkers, and lecturers there are out here, and frankly, future guests of Capitol Record. For this week's podcast, I'm really excited to introduce Dr. Mark Skousen, who is a well-known American economist. I've been reading him and his writings for many, many years. He currently does serve as a presidential fellow at Chapman University, which is in Orange County, California, where I have mostly grown up. But he's been at a number of different places over the years. He was at one point president at the Foundation for Economic Education. He's written a plethora of books, some of which are just absolute masterpieces. And so he really, as an academic economist, covers the gamut, and I think is a tremendous defender of a free society. And I'm excited to welcome Mark Skousen to the Capitol Record. And with that said, welcome to another episode of the Capitol Record podcast brought to you by National Review. I am your host, David Bonson, and very excited to welcome for the first time to our podcast, Dr. Mark Skousen. Mark, welcome to Capitol Record.
David, it's a real pleasure.
Well, I actually just got to meet Mark face-to-face for the first time a couple of months ago, although I have been reading him for many, many years. I'm going to let you sort of introduce yourself to our audience, and then I'll share a story as to kind of where I first got turned on to your work many years ago. But maybe tell us a little bit about what you're doing now at Chapman and a couple of the kind of places you've been over your distinguished economic career.
Well, thank you. Just in terms of my background, I've always had an interest in economics and in finance and in mathematics and in politics and writing, and economics seemed to fit the bill. So I got a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, and a PhD in economics. My economics was at George Washington University, and it was on the monetary, on the gold standard. So monetary economics is a field I've been interested in. But it was interesting that when I took these 3 degrees in economics, I never once took a class in finance, business management, accounting, personal finance. Can you imagine? But that's how narrowly focused economics has been. And I think it's unfortunate. I think it's expanding now. So I consider myself a financial economist. So I learned accounting and finance and running and business management, running my own businesses and becoming an applied economist in the 80s, starting my own investment newsletter. My wife and I and our children, we've traveled to many countries. I've been to 77 countries. I've written over 25 books on finance, largely on financial and economic topics. And more importantly, I thought I owed it to students to bring to the classroom my experiences in applied economics and finance. So at Columbia Business School, I taught there for a couple of years, at Columbia University. I taught money and banking and had gold and silver coins to circulate among the students. And it was a really good experience. And so I've been at Chapman University now for 6 or 7 years as a presidential fellow. I teach economics, business, and finance, teach puzzles and paradoxes in economics, financial economics, libertarian CEOs. And last but not least, I produce Freedom Fest, which is a for-profit conference that we hold every year in July. I know, David, you're going to be there, I believe, for the first time in this July in Las Vegas. We're very excited to have you. But it's really, I try to do my part, my share, if you will, just as you do, to try to make a difference, a positive contribution, as small as it may be in today's world of uncertainty and bear markets and crises and all the things that we face. I, I would like to think that they're listening to us, that somebody out there that's engaged in policy is listening to us, that there's no free lunch is the title of your book. By the way, we're going to have a wonderful half-hour sit-down discussion with you about your book. And I should tell you, I have in my library books of opposite titles. So next to your book, There's No Free Lunch, I have another book called So What's Wrong with a Free Lunch?
and so what's the premise of that book, dare I ask?
Oh, it's basically an argument that you shouldn't deny basic essentials of food, shelter, medical help to any individual. Everybody has a right to these things. So it's the free lunch scenario that we're living with. Free school education, free medical, universal medical services. And as I try to teach my students, once you make something valuable, a valuable commodity or service for free, you create all kinds of problems, because once the price is free, then somebody else has to pay. There's no incentive to shop around. There's no incentive to improve the technology. There's lots of problems, as you know, with the free lunch mentality. And countries that have adopted free everything end up with shortages, long lines, poor quality service, and they have to go elsewhere, just like Canadians have to go to the United States to have surgery.
Well, let's stay on this track for a moment. I'm going to come back to some of the stuff you brought up in your background as a monetary economist. I want to hit up on something you brought up about them not teaching finance and so forth in the economic profession. But when you talk about this no free lunch issue, I titled my book there because I thought it captured truly important philosophical component about scarcity, about the reality of trade-offs that is at the root of scarcity and therefore at the root of human action, to borrow a sort of Austrian nomenclature. And from there, it tees up my ability to go into all the places I think are important to go in starting off a conversation about economic theory and practice, particularly the anthropology, the role of a human person, and so forth. And so There's No Free Lunch has a lot of meaning. But when you talk about people that are in defense of free lunch, is it a defense of the welfare state that they're after, that they believe in, that all they're really doing is kind of offering a sort of political statement in defense of redistribution? Or do they actually deny scarcity? Would they deny the economic theorems that you're referring to about how it distorts price discovery, about how it leads to shortages? Those flaws that you mentioned seem economically indisputable. So is the agenda in the pro-free lunch crowd merely political?
No, I think it's a genuine, we always have this debate about people that who don't see the way things we do, and we often call them evil. And I preferred Milton Friedman's view that they are simply ignorant of sound economics, that they're not necessarily bad people. They just see people hungry, people not getting good medical service. And they say, in a world of superabundance, why can't we provide food, decent housing? Why do we have this homeless problem? Why do we have to provide food stamps and that sort of thing? People maybe just aren't capable of producing enough goods and services that you and I want to make it worth their while. So I actually talk about the A&W principle to my students. This is a wonderful experiment with my students. So A stands for accountability. It means the user pay, and that's the market system. When you go into a shopping mall, you're paying for what you buy, and most in our enterprise system works on that basis. There's also the welfare principle. The welfare principle is, well, you help those who need help. And that's what they really focus on. These people need help, so let's give them assistance. The problem is that we are often too generous with that. You help those who need help, but it's very important you don't help those who don't need help. Because otherwise you destroy the accountability principle. So this A&W are constantly struggling in a battle that if you're too generous with welfare, you hurt the accountability principle. You don't provide incentives. So there is a trade-off, but I prefer to emphasize incentives. I think economics is more about incentives than anything else. And one of the things I do with my students, I write on the board a quote from Karl Marx, but I don't tell them it's Karl Marx. I just put the quote on the board, and it says, from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. So I say, you work hard and you get what you need. How many would be in favor of this motto? And of course, I have students always, a majority raise their hand. Boy, this sounds really great. In fact, even at Hillsdale College, I put this quote on the board and over half the students raised their hand. It was a good idea. And I said, well, let's put your economics hat on. I always wear a hat. That's kind of my signature thing. And I said, let's put your economics hat on and say, well, what happens? How much money do you need to live on, students? And of course, the California students are out of this. They're saying $70,000 to $100,000. They need minimum just to live. And I said, okay, so what happens if you earn more than $100,000? What happens to that money under this system? And of course, the answer is it's taken away from you and put into the community fund to help those who didn't earn $100,000 a year. And I said, so what's the marginal tax rate? And there'll be a pause that will last almost for several minutes. And finally, one student who's bright enough will say, oh, I guess it's 100%, 100% marginal tax rate. So I said, what incentive do you have to earn more than 100,000? And the answer is zero, unless you're just doing it out of your goodwill. And I said, well, what about those who earn only 50,000 and need an additional 50,000? Where do they get that? Well, from the community fund that the wealthy pay into. And I said, well, what incentive do they have to earn more than 50,000? Well, they don't have any because they're automatically getting it up to 100,000. You can see why this system called socialism fails every time because it lacks the proper incentives. And it's like a light going on with the students. And I do this with adults as well. I think it would work with some of these Democrats who advocate these socialistic measures. So it's a really good exercise. I really thoroughly enjoy teaching students. It kind of renews my faith in America to see young people getting it. It may be a small number, but it makes a difference.
Do you run into those who deny the application of incentives-based thinking, that someone who makes 100 and can't keep any of it above 100, that they would lack the incentive to produce more than 100? Do you run into those who deny that, as Jude Wanitsky said, that's the way the world works?
Yes. Well, in fact, Paul Samuelson, the MIT professor, Keynesian economist, argued that wealthy people are going to earn a lot of money, even if the marginal tax rate is 70 or 80 or 90%, it's not going to keep them from working hard. So you do have this concept. And in fact, a number of Keynesian economists say the marginal tax rate can go up to 70% without effective incentives. I think they have no real world experience, as Jude Wanitsky says, because I was just reading the other day where somebody said that they have very strong, they're a very wealthy person. They have a great incentive to engage in tax shelters and move to a low income tax state like Texas and Florida. And these are with marginal tax rates of 50 or 60%. So you can't tell me that it doesn't cause behavioral change with those higher interest rates. But I will say, that the kibbutz in Israel has followed this Marxist motto for some time, and they have existed for over 100 years. However, they are struggling a lot, and young people in particular are not sticking around the kibbutzes. They're leaving, and there has been a crisis there. So these systems that lack incentives but have compassion, if you will, can last for a while, but it seems that it's not a viable system for the long term, like what I call democratic capitalism, which is sharing the wealth. Henry Ford was the first one to do that with his $5 a day, where he shared the profits with his workers. And I'm a big fan of stock options and profit sharing and those kinds of methods of making sure workers feel that they're benefiting from an expanding, successful business.
I always think that it's interesting, those examples about like the kibbutzes in Israel, where we take a micro chapter of a community but ignore a sort of macroeconomic dynamic where the whole country still has a democratic capitalistic orientation. The military has to be funded. There's still trade agreements. And so you look at the economic practices within one microcosm that itself is a beneficiary of the bigger picture, where there is more open markets and more full-blown incentives playing out in economic application. It always seems to me those things are questionable analogies.
Yeah, this is all about business management and the best strategies out there to make sure you have a successful organization or company or society. And the kibbutz is voluntary. It's communitarian. Nobody owns personal property. So you're not going to ever get rich. However, I noticed they're very export oriented now. And they do make a lot of money, and they share it among themselves. So as long as they're becoming financially successful. But it's really important, the big difference between voluntary and force, mandates and taxation, that is definitely not the way to go in our society. And I fear that we're constantly either being mandated or prohibited from doing X, Y. So it's like those old movies where the walls are closing in on you and we're losing our freedom from both sides. Our theme for Freedom Fest this year is turning the tide. And with government now taking 50% of GDP, I don't know if you're aware of that or not, but
oh yeah,
they were half slave and half free. Now, so we've got to reverse that. That's crazy.
So I want to come back to what may be wrong in the economics profession in a moment. But I guess when you bring up Freedom Fest and a lot of the really strong political themes that are demonstrated from stage, the speakers that have strong, whether it be libertarian or conservative principles, I have used this line, Mark, many times in talking about my book, that I think so many people get their economic beliefs from their politics instead of getting their political policy applications from their economics. They develop an economic worldview that then leads to policy applications. And yet I think so many people are doing the opposite, that they have a political instinct that then leads to what they might think in an economic application sense. Do you believe that I am right about what the error there is? Should we be getting our politics from our economics or vice versa? If you understand kind of where I'm coming from in the question here.
Well, certainly political economy is what we used to call economics prior to 1890, when Alfred Marshall came up with the title economics, because he wanted to make it an objective science. He didn't want it to be political. But if you look at Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, he wrote that book specifically, and not so much as an economics textbook, but to apply it to political issues of the day, and his advocacy of free trade, his objection to mercantilism, which is basically the government interfering with every aspect of your life, where you worked, what you did, your licensing, prices, wages. I mean, they interfered in every way. And he called this mercantilism. And it was basically a wholesale attack on government interference in the economy, and argued that individuals on their own would make better decisions that would benefit not only themselves, but the public in general. That would be the invisible hand doctrine. And it would be under the rule of law, because you can't, he wasn't advocating anarchy. So it was a new model, of economics. And out of that grew this more objective philosophy. But economics, we want it to be objective, unbiased, no confirmation bias. But let's just look at the data and see what the data tells us. And there are some economists that do that, but it's really difficult to pull yourself away from your own political views. Take, for example, the minimum wage debate. I find it interesting that you have studies arguing both sides of this issue, that one bunch of studies show that if you raise the minimum wage, you have the standard supply and demand policy, and it causes unemployment. It causes companies to automate. It has a lot of unintended consequences. And then you have other people say, no, it has no effect at all. Now, actually, I actually do a wonderful objective supply and demand analysis on all of these different studies that so the students don't know what my view is on the minimum wage law. I start off by giving these examples, and on the one hand you have this case, on the other hand you have this case. And then I say, put your economics hat on and let's do the supply and demand analysis. And this is not the time to show you what I do, because it has to be visual that you actually see. But when it's all through, students, again, a light has gone on. They say, oh, well, that explains why sometimes the unemployment rate does not go up when they raise the minimum wage. And of course, there's an explanation as to why that can happen. And then you show examples where it does cause unemployment. So it's very enlightening to do an objective analysis, but it's extremely difficult, because you're right. The unions, for example, the union economists almost always just look for the data to confirm their own bias, that unions are good, that minimum wage should be raised, collective bargaining is a good thing, and stuff like that. It is very difficult to find people willing to change. And one thing about Freedom Fest is we call it the largest gathering of free minds. So we ask for you is, when you come there, is to have an open mind and not be closed-minded, and listen to the other point of view. We have tons of debates at Freedom Fest. We have our mock trial. We have various debates on all kinds of topics. And these are civil debates. They are we try to do formal debates, so you don't talk over each other. You give both sides of the issues, and then we see if that doesn't change some people's minds. And it's rather unusual perspective, because most of the time, people are just adamant about their views and they're not willing to see any other perspective.
Do you believe that when we talk about getting the data and having objective information as economists, do you lean more into the Austrian view that some of these things are not empirically verifiable? Time and place circumstances change. There is a sort of the Austrian school will use the term praxeology, a kind of a logic in human action that will allow for different treatment of events and inputs that affect production and consumption over time. And so the mere observation of data is less useful to the economist than understanding the logic of human action. Would you be sensitive to that view, or do you like the idea of economists believing that they can be just mere aggregators and interpreters of objective data?
So I wrote a book called Vienna and Chicago, Friends or Foes, about the difference between the Austrian school and the Chicago school. Wrote that several years ago, and they differ on like four major issues. And one of them is this methodology and whether you can use empirical data to support a particular, to test, if you will, a particular thesis in economics. And I have looked at both of these perspectives, and I really fall more on the Chicago side on this, to be honest with you. I just think there's too many cases where actual empirical evidence really is helpful to figure out what is going on and actually to learn new things. For example, inflationary recession. How do you explain stagflation? How do you explain that? Well, the Keynesians didn't have a method to do that because they just had aggregate demand. So they added aggregate supply, and lo and behold, they now have an explanation for that. And even the Austrians, Murray Rothbard said, yeah, we hadn't really thought about that. But here's my Austrian explanation that he has in America's Great Depression in one of the editions, the revised editions. So even he learned that inside the theory, there is evidence for what you actually see in the real world, inflation and a recession at the same time. So even he learned from empirical work. In America's Great Depression, by the way, he provided all this kind of empirical evidence to show that the 1920s was a artificial bubble. I think he used the data. He really stretched some of the data in order to prove that. But even he succumbed to the use of testing of a theory, the Austrian theory of the business cycle, in his book, America's Great Depression. So I really side on the Chicago school on this. I think if you just stay in high theory, that you're not going to get anywhere in making the case, although it certainly simplifies the issue. But I don't think it's particularly helpful to make a convincing case for the policies that you're recommending.
So it's funny you brought that book up, because that is the book that introduced me to you, in the sense of I was familiar with you before, knew the name, had read other things you had putting out, and I've been reading economic newsletters and things for you know, decades, and yet that book was something that no one else has written. Where I kind of grew up in the Austrian camp, I consider myself more sympathetic with much of the Austrian world, and yet there was something gnawing at me, which was the fact that they were wrong about a bunch of stuff. And I couldn't reconcile that, where I liked a lot of the theory and yet was concerned about some of the predictions that some of their leading spokespeople had made over the years. And I'm thinking of guys like Murray and Gary North and others. And I said, what am I missing here? And yet I was a freedom-driven economist, and I loved Milton Friedman, and I had read Schumpeter, and I didn't really ever find Friedrich Hayek to be an obnoxious Austrian. I thought there was a really different manner in his writing philosophically. So I read the Chicago School and monetarism and a number of the great scholars and economists and practitioners. And I found myself in this internal conflict where there was a lot about both schools I agreed with. And then I came across your book and I said, well, here's an economic intellectual actually writing about this internal split I've been going through. And yet what is interesting is it sounds to me like you, in your synthesis of the two schools, that you have kind of certain sympathies for both and agreements for both, that you're more attracted to the monetary theory of Austrianism and yet the methodology of the Chicago school, where I found myself more attracted to the praxeology of Austrianism and some of the monetary realities of Chicago. So am I summarizing this correctly? Maybe get to kind of the heart of where you feel in your own economic worldview, Chicago, Vienna and Chicago come together?
Yeah, so they disagree on four major issues. And I remember at the end, I ended up having my foot in two of the camp, in the Austrian camp twice, and the Chicago school twice. So I offended both sides, although I did get a very nice letter from Milton Friedman, as well as Roger Garrison and Art Laffer, among others, who really liked the book, and I put them, their quotes are in the on the back of the book.
And I'll read real quickly for our listeners. Milton Friedman said of your book, "This tale is thorough, thoughtful, even-handed, and highly readable. All economists of whatever school will find it instructive and entertaining." And then, of course, Roger Garrison, well-known from the Austrian school, said, in his upbeat Tale of Two Schools, Skousen gives us a delightful blend of theory, history, and political science and shows there is much common ground and scope for development.
Yeah, and I actually focused on the differences between the two schools, even though I did have a couple of pages where, well, these are the areas where the Austrian and Chicago school agree. You know, we meet every other year at the Mount Pelerin Society meetings, which was this established by Hayek, and Milton Friedman and George Stigler from the Chicago School were there along with Ludwig von Mises. And it was interesting. All the photographs show Milton Friedman on one side and Mises on the other side of the room. There's no picture of them together. And so the fights between the Chicago and Austrians have been pretty vicious to some extent. It's really unfortunate where they focus on their disagreements more than their agreements. But one of the things that I'm like you that turned me off about the Austrian school was they were all pessimists, that they were really good at predicting the crashes and the bear markets and so on. And they were anticipating it due to the point where they ignored the bull market. It turns out that bull markets last a lot longer than bear markets. And so the idea of you making money just by being a bear is a difficult one. And you know, what's really strange is the Austrian theory of the business cycle, which is very applicable to today, says that you have an inflationary boom through easy money policies. And yes, it is unsustainable. The bull markets, the boom in real estate and the stock market and in manufacturing is excessive, and you know it's going to collapse at some time. But the problem is you don't know when. It's impossible. Even the Austrians were never particularly that great about it. I mean, Ludwig von Mises was predicting the stock market crash of 29 way back in 24. Yeah. So you had plenty of time to make a lot of money before the inverted yield curve shows up, which is an Austrian way. I don't know if you look at the inverted yield curve, but I think it's a pretty good Austrian indicator rather than the real 10-year note. And so the Austrian school has been very good at predicting these recessions, but also let us not ignore the boom phase. So we enjoyed the boom phase. Now we're in the bear phase. There's no question about it that we're headed for a recession, that the stock market is anticipating that. The silver lining, of course, is that the Republicans will hopefully take over the Capitol Hill and bring back a little bit of sanity back into the model. I'm not particularly impressed with the Republicans during peacetime and during the periods of prosperity, because yeah, they're great on tax cuts, but they're not very good on controlling government spending, and Fed policy continues to be boom bust, continues to be tight money, easy money, tight money, easy money. We go back and forth. One thing I do think the Chicago school has an upper hand in is not going back to the gold standard, because I just don't think that's viable. But I do see, couldn't we have a more stable monetary policy? Do we have to go through easy money, tight money, fighting recession, fighting inflation? Can't we just have a stable? I like Friedman's original book, A Program for Monetary Stability, where he said, well, we just kind of increase the money supply very steadily. We don't put in too much. We don't put in too little. We just keep it steady, run by a computer. Maybe we can use M3 or something like that. It's got to be better than what we have today.
Well, I got to say, I think on this issue, it's fascinating that the tension is so high within shared commitments to classical economics, within shared commitments to a sort of laissez-faire understanding of the relationship between the market and the state, that the Austrians and monetarists would be so at war when there is clearly periods in which their respective theories have demonstrated greater favor to one side versus the other, and then other periods where it's moved the other way. You would think there'd be some intellectual humility after 100 years of this. But I think you brought up this issue of pessimism. And I do view, Mark, candidly, the notion of theory transcending empirical observation in economics as a strength of the Austrian school, to the extent that I think the theoretical and the presuppositional are where we have to start, and that empirical can be inadequate when it doesn't allow for cause and effect. It doesn't necessarily enable us to understand. We can view empirically something that happened, but that doesn't allow us, apart from theory, to know if what happened was the cause of something or the effect of something else. And so we can talk ourselves in circles if we divorce from theory. And my fear is that the more statist-oriented systems of thought are the ones that favor this really high-handed commitment to data, because they're the ones who get to apply the data. They get to interpret the data. It's sort of we're walking into the trap of the central planners to some degree. Do you have any sympathy to that view? Or do you think that over the course of the last 100 years, that much of what the Austrians were concerned about the inadequacy of mathematical models, has been arbitraged away, that we now do have really reliable data and model building that can solve our economic woes?
Remember, there was I'm trying to think of the fellow's name who was in charge of the government economic policy in Hong Kong in the 50s and 60s, Kouth Braten or something like that.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
So Milton Friedman, he said, now, what was really interesting was that he didn't believe in macro statistics at all. He didn't put together any kind of mathematical, no GDP statistics, no inflation figures, nothing. He thought if you just have a basic, correct view of how the system works, everything will work out fine. You don't need these statistics and so forth. And I think that that's kind of a dream world for these Austrians, although Milton Friedman himself spoke rather highly about this guy, that he was, laissez-faire, let things alone, let them run
why,
on their
why
own.
Why does it have to be either or? Why can't we say that models and mathematics can reveal preferences, but that human behavior is too dynamic to stay constant over time and context?
I actually think the key here is that we can learn theory from empirical studies. All right. I use my inflationary recession as an example. Nobody thought it would exist, and then it existed, and then they went back and said, oh, it's in the theory. We just didn't see it before. The other thing is that the theory says, the Austrian theory of the business cycle, it says that if you adopt an easy money policy, it's going to cause the structure of production to expand. It's going to cause excessive growth in the earlier stages of production. It's going to cause a bubble, an inflationary boom that's unsustainable in stocks, real estate, and so forth. Okay, that I get. And it eventually must turn into a bust because there's no free lunch, right? There's no free lunch.
That's right.
However, where is the theory that's very important, but where is the theory that the inflationary boom lasts a lot longer than you expect, and the bear market, when you do get the crash, it's relatively short period compared. In other words, you have these long, the bull market lasts long, long periods of time. Then you have the crash, and then once again, it goes to the bull. Where is that in the theory? And it's a very important thing for you and I who are in this business. We need that. We need to know why that is the case, because we only have the empirical evidence that's the case, but we don't have a theory. The stock market takes the stairs up and the elevator down. But what's the theory behind that? The Austrians don't have a theory behind that. I'm not even sure the Chicago School has a theory.
No, but I do. And so in that case, I guess the part I'm saying is Austrian is the need to have a theory. I just think they fail their own commitments to a priori reasoning so often. Otherwise, they wouldn't all be gold bugs, right? They wouldn't all be so pessimistic. Like, as a supply-sider, as a classical economist, as a pro-markets guy who believes in human action, all of these things come from theory for me, and yet they lead me to be generally bullish and optimistic.
You're a rare case here, David, and so am I. We're in this bullish camp long term, or almost permabulls. But you have to remember that Mises and Hayek cut their teeth. They became famous because they predicted the 29 crash and the Great Depression, and Keynes and Taussig and Fisher did not. They failed miserably in predicting this sort of thing. But here's the interesting thing. Mises, to his dying day, was a pessimist. Hayek, who was more upbeat, generally speaking, about life than Mises was, if you read his updated versions of his Road to Serfdom, How the Worst Get on Top, Chapter 10, I mean, this is pure pessimism that was written right at the end of World War II. But his updated versions, including the time period after Reagan and Thatcher were elected, who had read Hayek, he's still a pessimist. How do you explain that?
Well, and the way I explain it is that I don't think it's actually economic or philosophical for a lot of these people. I think it's sociological. And maybe that wasn't the case for von Mises. Maybe he was truly wired that he believed economically in a sort of pessimistic outcome and never was able to get out of it. But I think that in modern day Austrianism, I don't think a lot of people are pessimists because they're Austrians. I think they're Austrians because they're pessimists. And there is a sense in which the sort of political sociology, it's anti-establishment. Murray took it a little further than some, but it's a little anarcho-capitalist. And it's led to a lot of sort of counter-cultural thoughts. I think this was a lot of their embrace of the crypto craze, which was fundamentally against some of their own tenets about sound money over the years.
Yeah, the regression theorem by Mises, you have to have something backed with real value. But look, you have to – Murray Rothbard, by the way – he couldn't get it at all about Reaganomics. I mean, I recognize that this was a major, this was my very first call, 1981, for my newsletter that started in 1980. When Reagan won, I sent out a promotion that says, financial shock of 81, you open up the envelope and it says, Reaganomics will work, sell your gold and silver and buy stocks and bonds. Murray Rothbard never bought into that at all. He thought it was Reagan was a sham. He didn't make any change at all, and so forth. And by the way, I'm not sure you can say that they're pessimists, therefore they're Austrians, because pessimists also become Marxists. And Marxists are pessimists. They are as pessimistic as the Austrians. They always write these books called The Twilight of Capitalism. In my book, The Making of Modern Economics, which is my most successful book out there, I have my chapter on Marx. And the number one title of Marxist economists who are forecasting the future is always the twilight of capitalism. We're just about ready to end the capitalist system. And of course, they don't even read Marx, because Marx, even Marx said that they capitalism keeps renewing itself because of imperialism. They keep, the market keeps expanding and so forth. But the Marxists and the Austrians do have something in common. They're both pessimists. They're both predicting end of the world scenarios around the corner for different reasons.
And so from the various things that we both would agree with or disagree with within Austrianism, within monetarism, you and I find ourselves today in a world of kind of monetary insanity. Look, we had $17 trillion of negative yielding debt 4 years ago. We're getting close to zero now. There's so much tightening that has gone on that a lot of that debt is now trading into a positive yield, but nevertheless, extraordinary monetary experimentation, intervention, discretion. Are you in the camp, Mark, that we need a rules-based order in central banking, or would you get rid of a central bank altogether?
Yeah, I think it's unrealistic to think that the Federal Reserve and other central banks are going to be abolished, because you always have to say, well, with what? What are you going to replace it with? Because you have to have a monetary policy. I mean, this is, I was at the Libertarian National Convention last month, and Ron Paul was speaking. And as Ron Paul arrived, everyone said, "And the Fed, and the Fed." And of course, the Fed, he's been calling for that for 30 years, and it never has happened and never will happen, because there's too much power. And you also have financial crises that occur from time to time, and the Fed plays a central role. They may have caused the monetary crisis in the first place, but they're there to assist. I have this new book that just came out here. It's called Lords of Easy Money. Have you seen this book, Lords of Easy Money?
Yeah, I've had the author on this very podcast.
Yeah, so his subtitle, though, I disagree with. I mean, he's definitely Lords of Easy Money. How the Federal Reserve broke the American economy, and I thought, well, no. They didn't break the American economy. They created a overwhelming artificial bubble economy. That's what they did. I don't think they broke it. In fact, no. They intervened in 2008 very heavily in order to keep the economy from collapsing. So I thought that was a strange subtitle.
I think we had the author on the podcast. And I think, first of all, titles generally, have more to do with selling the book than describing the book, of course. But
yeah.
What I think he would say is that they, kind of reinforced a fragility that now we're dealing with. The QE world may have done certain things to stabilize financial markets or feel like financial markets are more stable. And yet, because we never got off of the QE, they left this open-ended experimentation that created a lot of vulnerability, and I'm certainly sensitive to that view. It's a really good book, and that podcast, by the way, is our most downloaded episode that we've ever had.
No kidding.
So, wow. It speaks to the fact, and he wasn't a particularly well-known author or name. I've had much more famous people than him on the podcast, but I think that it speaks to how interesting that subject is to people. So, but when you say they won't get rid of the Fed, which you're right about, and that it's too powerful and vital, that's the descriptive answer to why Ron Paul's, screaming to get rid of the Fed isn't going to happen. But I guess I'm asking prescriptively, should they get rid of the Fed? Should there be no central monetary authority? And if you, as I feel, know there should be, I'm curious what you think that ideal might be on this side of the gold standard. Or I happen to know you don't believe we can go back to the gold standard. Some would say that we could do that. But what would you like to see if you could just wave a wand of all your economic expertise and experience and create a monetary paradigm that would be better than the highly discretionary one we have with the J-PAL Fed?
And so I go back to the Federal Reserve founding principles and what are their goals. I don't like these goals of unemployment, full employment as a goal. I think that is unnecessary. If you have a relatively unfettered labor market, I don't see that as a particular problem or a goal in that sense. I think that would be the effect of a more stable policy. But I do like the idea of a lender of last resort. I do think that that is really important. And so you need to have some kind of performance that the Fed engages in when that sort of situation arises for whatever reason. But I want to get away. Somehow we have to get away from the tight money, easy money, fight recession, fight inflation, the two scenarios. And you see, there's this long-term trend where interest rates kept going down, down, down. But in between, they were going up and up, up, down, up, down, up, down, on the way to this long-term downward trend in interest rates. So it's kind of an interesting phenomenon since Paul Volcker at the Fed. I'm wondering if we can smooth that out better. And I do think that the Fed artificially lowered interest rates too frequently. And then they would abruptly, like they're doing right now, abruptly changing. And now we're going to raise rates because we've got to fight this inflation. And it creates its own crisis. So is there a way? The biggest problem, you know, we'll go back to Milton Friedman's idea of a computer increasing the money supply equal to the long-term economic growth rate. I like that idea. I just wish we could incorporate it more. So in my book, The Making of Modern Economics, it says, you know, economists have done a great job solving all the various problems of understanding how the world works and stuff like that, with one exception. There's only one area which they have not been able to resolve, and that's the ideal monetary policy. And so I'd like to see a broad-based M3 money supply increasing at a very stable rate. And then I would remove one power from the Fed, and that is their manipulation of short-term interest rates. You have to allow the discount rate. I don't mind the discount rate and the Fed funds rate, but it should be determined solely by the bond market. Whatever the bond market does, the Fed does, but not the other way around, which is what it is now.
Well, you are preaching to the choir. Everything you just said is exactly how I feel on this subject. And so it further reinforces maybe why we are becoming fast friends. This is something that's so important. When we decide to criticize the Fed, either as conservatives or as economists or what have you, I want so badly for us to get the criticism right. And when we start saying things like we don't need any central bank, I think that it kind of misses the mark and sets us up for another problem in another area of our economic practice. And yet I most certainly believe the area in which they deserve the most criticism is this exacerbation of booms and busts, like what you've talked about. And I think that you're right, that the short-term interest rate as their primary policy tool of manipulation, as opposed to being that lender of last resort, and as opposed to an administrator in the money supply, which I think could be rules-based, it could be Friedman-like, in allowing for a steady growth of supply and keeping with the growth of the economy. I think Scott Sumner has some interesting ideas here on nominal GDP targeting. There's ideas out there intellectually, but when you say we just haven't ever really gotten monetary policy right, it strikes me that most of the reason we haven't got it right is where we allowed monetary policy to transcend monetary policy. In other words, the Fed right now talking about climate change, the Fed talking about racial equity and justice, the Fed back in 2009 trying to deal with commercial mortgage-backed securities. Much of what has gone wrong with the Fed is because we're not even asking the Fed to be the Fed. We're asking it to do things that there's no way a central bank can do. And yet I don't think this is Wall Street's problem anymore. I think it's Main Street. I think that we all believe that there is some conference room table of experts that have their hands on the levers of the economy and that they can make it all just right. And I think we have got to stop thinking that way.
I don't think their comments on global warming and stuff like that, an inequality issue. There's a number of issues that they can talk all they want about, but they're not really making any policy decisions with the Fed to deal right. with that. What I would like to see is them using the bully pulpit to condemn fiscal policy. The out-of-control government spending, which is 50% of GDP now, they need to be more critical of them and set themselves up as the stabilizing factor in the economy. Fiscal policy, despite what Milton Friedman said, I still think fiscal policy is extremely important. It may be not necessarily in the business cycle per se, but it does put pressure on the Fed to expand the money supply, to engage in these easy money policies. They certainly were accommodating in March of 2020 when the fiscal people shut down the economy. I mean, how stupid was that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Look, Mark, we can go back and forth on so many issues all day. I've used up more of your time than I said I was going to. I'd love to have you back on the podcast, maybe after Freedom Fest. We can do this again and kind of revisit some of the highlights of your conference.
Well, thank you. And I hope those who listen, assuming this comes out before Freedom Fest.
It will. Yeah, it'll come out real soon. Yeah.
Yeah. So we'd love to have people. We're expecting 2,000 people there and we have room for more people. And if they go to freedomfest.com, they can get all the details on how to register and stuff. And we'd love to see them there.
Well, thanks so much. I will put the info on Freedom Fest in the show notes of this episode. And I can't emphasize enough that everyone listening, follow the work of Mark Skousen, a great writer, thinker, longtime economic intellectual, advancing the cause of a free and virtuous society. Mark, thank you for joining us on the Capitol Record.
David, thank you. That was a lot of fun.
Well, I hope that you enjoyed that talk. It was kind of a shame for me to have to cut it off because I felt like there were a couple of things I wanted to keep digging at with him, and one of those was what he brought up about them not necessarily teaching finance to economic students. And I wanted to ask him what he thinks about why they don't teach economics to finance students, which I reckon to be a bigger problem. But we'll save that for our next conversation. Obviously, there's a lot he has to offer in the world of monetary economics. He's committed to applying economic principles into the realm of policy. And, you know, there's probably a few things he and I would disagree on here and there. I think that that notion about the tension between, shall we say, theory and objective data, I think that could be better stated, but he and I would have needed more time to unpack that. But I enjoyed the conversation a great deal. I hope you enjoyed listening to it, and I hope you will share Capitol Record with every man, woman, and child you talk to, that we will share this message and that we will get this podcast out, subscribed into people's feeds so that we all together can work on advancing our aim of a free and virtuous society. Thank you for listening to The Capitol Record.